business of our luncheon meeting. Please carry on with lunch, with dessert, with coffee, and don't mind us while you're doing that. At the outset, on behalf of everyone here, certainly all members of the Philadelphia Society and our guests, I want to thank our Secretary for Life, the Reverend Dr. Herr Professor William F. Campbell Dada, and Julie Flick, the real power behind the throne, for a wonderful job of organizing our meeting. And at the same time, I think it's really important, appropriate to thank as well our friends and colleagues at the Heritage Foundation, particularly Bridget Wagner and Ed Fulner. For some years now, Heritage has dovetailed its annual Resource Bank meeting with the annual national meeting of the Philadelphia Society. It's been a very happy marriage or partnership, and they help a lot in organizing the place and the logistics and so forth. So we thank them as well. Three officers of the Philadelphia Society retire, and it's become my custom to commence these more or less annual addresses, urbe et orbe, regarding the Philadelphia Society, by acknowledging them. With the end of this meeting, we lose our distinguished president, Klaus Rinn, our our first vice president, George Carey, and our second vice president, Jane Shaw Stroop. I thank them all. For splendid service and organizing this year's annual meeting. The members of the Society have already heard the news, but the conclave was held yesterday. There was white smoke. We have a new president. The president-elect of the Philadelphia Society, who will take office at the close of this meeting, is Edwin Meese III of Virginia. The first vice president-elect is Ellen McDonald of Alabama. And the second vice president-elect is Eduardo Mayorga of Guatemala. And already there's trouble. Meese from Virginia, McDonald from Alabama are already talking secession. And Mayorga of Guatemala is already plotting a coup. Kathy and I and Christy and Alan Reynolds had the great privilege of being the guests of Eduardo Mayorga and Giancarlo Ibargen and Musso, Manuel Ayao, at Universidad Marroquín in Guatemala City last summer for an outstanding seminar conducted by the Liberty Fund. And I was witness to a conversation between Alan Reynolds and our second vice president-elect, Eduardo Mayorga, which put a chill down my spine. Alan Reynolds said to Eduardo, "So tell me, Ed, what's your favorite sport here in Guatemala?" And Senor Mayorga responded, "Bullfighting." And Alan Reynolds said, "Ooh, isn't it revolting?" And Eduardo said, "No, that's our second favorite sport." So all I can tell you, Ed, is watch your back. We have elected some returning officers, of course. David Storr returns as our treasurer. Daniel B. Hales of Chicago returns as our assistant secretary. And, surprise, re-elected as our secretary is Bill Campbell. The following trustees-elect take office at the close of this meeting: Linda Bridges, Stephen Ely, Winston Elliott, the Baron, John von Cannon, and Michael Wallachavage. I love to pronounce that name, and I'll do so several different times before the meeting ends, several different ways. I also announce the election of five new trustees-elect who will take office a year from now. We're very conservative in our internal governance here. And these members of the Politburo have to serve a time as candidate members. Stephen Balch, Joe Baldacchino of the National Humanities Institute now, Professor Brad Berzer, whom we heard from this morning, Midge Dechter, and Ingrid Marikowski. And the mantle of new membership has been conferred upon the following candidates, a list of 10. See if you can discern the pattern here. New members of the Philadelphia Society just elected are Barry Cooper from the Fraser Institute in Calgary, Marshall DeRosa, a legal scholar who's an expert on the Confederate Constitution, which is really useful since nobody pays much attention to the other one. We might as well study one. Richard Gamble, Mark Henry of ISI, Ross Lentz, who has a really wicked sense of humor, Gordon Lloyd of Pepperdine, who has a really wicked sense, Tim Lomperis, who studied political theory at the University of Chicago, which endears him to me, Ginny McLeith, an accountant, James Martin, and Andrew Youngert. Now, have you discerned the pattern? 1 and 9. 9 males and 1 accountant. We have also elected a life member, Eric Brodin. And of course, it was announced last night, but I'll repeat it anyway. We have a new distinguished member of the society, Forrest MacDonald. And I think Forrest MacDonald got off absolutely the most hilarious line of the entire conference last night when he thanked us for conferring the honor on him. Speaking of MacDonalds, I know a number of you have been very worried. You saw on the attendance list the expected attendance of our dear friend, the enchanting and lovely Agnes MacDonald. If you have your lists, you're premature. If you have your lists, you check your list and you will see listed as Agnes MacDonald. And in fact, at the front desk, there was a name tag for Agnes MacDonald. And of course, behind this lies a story, for we've all been wondering, where is the fair and lovely Agnes MacDonald? Well, here's the story. Agnes, long viewing herself as a man trapped in a woman's body, decided to seek a sex change, but true to her Scottish heritage, wanted to do it on the cheap. So she drove from her home in Stillwater, Minnesota, where she edits the St. Croix Review, known in my study as the St. Croix Review, and had the surgery done by Canada's National Health Service. I am delighted to report that he is here. And now, will you stand up, please? Agnes MacDonald. Now Angus. Angus MacDonald. And the good news is that Angus, as we call him now, Angus got the surgery for free The bad news is, before the surgery, she was 6 feet tall and 24 years of age. I want to thank Angus for being such a good sport, and also Dr. Julie Flick, who performed the surgery. Now I must turn to the sad news of the necrology of our society. In the last year, we lost some very good friends. Fortunately, not too many, but some very good friends. Glenn Campbell, Eugene Davidson, and John Ryan. I'm delighted to report that John Ryan will continue to vote from Indianapolis, Indiana. And Ernst Vandenhag, scholar, professor of jurisprudence, many times a speaker at this conference, and perhaps America's foremost advocate of the death penalty, began in-depth research on that subject on the 21st of March, and he will be missed. The cause of death in Ernst's case, by the way, was listed as living in New Jersey. Now we've added a new department to the Urbe et Orbe address this year. Those who are not yet dead, but have been rumored, and want it clear that they're not. Jay Parker is here, 65 years old. Jay. Donald Rumsfeld has become the national stud muffin, the stud muffin of the Philadelphia Society, not yet dead. The mayor of Ashorokan, father of 24-month-old Morgan and 8-month-old Kevin, Mayor Bill Kelly. Stand up, Bill. And I am pleased to report that Ed Fulner's beloved uncle, still living in the family home in Chicago, Rip Van Fulner, is still alive. Rip has been, as some of you may know, Rip has been in a coma for the last quarter of a century and woke up just last week, opened his eyes, and said to the nurse attending at his bedside, "Tell me, what's the big news going on after a quarter of a century?" And she said, "Well, there's war in the Middle East." And he said, well, who's leading the Arabs? And she said, Yasser Arafat. And he said, well, who's our Secretary of Defense? And she said, Don Rumsfeld. And he said, well, then closer to home, who's the mayor of Chicago? And she said, Richard Daley. And he said, well, tell me, what did the Cubs do yesterday? And she said, they lost. And he said, what place are the Cubs in? And she said, last. And finally, he said, well, where's my dear, closest living relative, my beloved nephew, Eddie Fulner? And she said, well, he's president of the Heritage Foundation. So he said, 25 years, nothing's changed, and he went back to bed. Well, enough with internal Philadelphia Society news. While we've been at lunch, there have been some major developments around the world, and I'm indebted to Stan Evans and the Baron von Cannon for bringing the news of the morning to us so that I can share it with you. A bulletin, the Children's Defense Fund today condemned the PLO and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade for child abuse. The European Union, having sent pacifists, so-called, to surround and protect Yasser Arafat, today announced an even-handed program. They're sending a division of beret-wearing European professionals to protect Israelis by sitting in street cafes along the Jaffa Road for hours at a time, sipping coffee. Congressman Barney Frank of Boston today called for the resignation of Bernard Cardinal Law, the Archbishop of Boston. Congressman Frank said that he was outraged that the Catholic Church cannot protect children from homosexual pedophiles. And he told a reporter from the New York Times, and I quote, "Why don't they just follow the model established by the Boy Scouts?" Um, noting Professor Bernard Sheehan's acknowledgement of the existence of a homosexual community, Congressman Frank said that reform should start in that community, and he said that henceforth he would no longer rent the basement of his townhouse to anyone other than heterosexual prostitutes. In other Catholic Church news, by the way, Trustee-elect Berzer, during his remarks this morning, spoke of his fear, I think was his word, of the liberalism of Catholics between 50 and 60, thus suggesting that age had something to do with it. Other ecclesiastical experts in the room advise me, however, that often the problem is more with the orders with which a Catholic priest are associated rather than necessarily the age of the Catholic faithful. There is, of course, the report of the Catholic who purchased a new car, a Lexus, and he went to his parish priest, a secular priest, and said, "You know, I'd like you to say a novena for my new Lexus." And the priest said to him, "What's a Lexus?" And he said, "Well, it's a relatively new kind of car, and I'd really feel better if I was driving it. You would be kind enough to pronounce these prayers over it." And the priest said, "That sounds a bit superstitious for my taste. I'll take a pass." So he went down the street to a Franciscan mission, and he went in and found the friar and said, "Would you be kind enough, please, to say a novena for my new Lexus?" And the Franciscan said, What's a Lexus?" And he explained it's a new car and so on. The Franciscan said, "No, that sounds too materialistic for me." So he goes down the street to a Jesuit church, and he steps inside, finds a Jesuit priest, and says, "Would you please say a novena for my new Lexus?" And the Jesuit says, "What's a novena?" John McCain's back in the news this morning. Having solved the problem of corruption in campaign finance by moving legislation that now puts the federal government in charge of regulating political speech and prohibits campaign speech within 30 days of elections, now has a new plan to solve the really vexing problem of bad judicial opinions. Under a new bill introduced today by Senator McCain, judges will be prohibited from reading the Constitution for 30 days prior to deciding any cases. There is an oil crisis brewing. As you know, as a result of events in the Middle East, the government of Iraq has suspended the sale of oil. There's also something happening in Venezuela. Manuel Ayau points out that the State Department does not allow states in the Americas to have coups anymore, so there's what's going on in Venezuela, what is called an assisted transition. As a result of this, however, there are oil shortages coming. And Republicans in Congress have pointed to the obvious solution. They claim it is to tap a great national resource, a source of a lot of oil, ANWR, the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. The congressional Democrats say, no, that makes no sense. We should tap a completely different national resource, a source of a great deal of oil, the otherwise unemployed Bill Clinton. Speaking of Bill Clinton, you all, I trust, saw within the last week or two the interview in Newsweek magazine in which he said he regretted his last-minute pardon of the felon, the expatriate fugitive, Mark Rich, because it damaged his reputation. And of course, up to that point, his reputation was okay. Now, speaking of foreign adventures... many of you have seen Linda Bridges limping around the conference on her crutches. And if you have asked her, "Linda, what happened to you?" she tells you this kind of phony cover story about a ski accident in Italy. Let me tell you the truth. Those of you who are at all close to the National Review family know that Linda Bridges is actually the thinly veiled role model for Bill Buckley's great fictional character, Blackford Oaks. Yes. And Linda was on a mission. In the Dolomites, the Italian mountains, she had under surveillance a European cell of Al-Qaeda. And she was detected. And as she tried to make her escape on skis, this much of the story is true, she's trying to make her escape down the mountain on skis, the Al-Qaeda terrorists fire gunshots at her, triggering an avalanche. She's getting down the mountain just ahead of the snow, and one of the terrorists, also on skis, armed with a gun, coming down after her, trying to intercept her. And at the bottom of the slope, stops and confronts Linda and says, and I quote, this is in the florid language of the way in which spies talk. I mean, you all know that, right? He says, "Falling rivers of ice and snow, roaring down the mountains by the ton, you will die, ha ha." And Linda Bridges said to him, "That's the most outrageous dangling participle I've ever encountered." Which stopped the terrorist dead in his tracks, and she made her escape. Along the way, breaking nothing grammatical, just a leg. So that's the true story of Linda Bridges, and which brings me remarkably enough to Terry Teachout. Who is one of the few people to have been edited closely by Linda Bridges and survived. Edited, of course, in the context of National Review, one of many publications for which Terry Teachout has written. Terry Teachout is a product of the American Midwest. His hometown is Sykesville, Missouri, and he has immortalized his youth in a fun book, City Limits, Memories of a Small Town Boy. In the 1980s, he came to New York. He went to New York to write for Harper's Magazine. Since that time, he has edited. He is at Harper's. He's written editorials for the Daily News. In the 90s, he became a freelance writer, and we have seen his byline and his work in many, many publications of the conservative movement and the general media. He's contributed to a number of books on letters, culture generally. His true love, it turns out, is music. He's contributed to the Oxford Companion to Jazz and other academic and popular reviews and criticisms of music. He also takes great pride in having being the author of a number of liner notes for jazz CDs. His tastes in music are broad and eclectic. He is married to an opera coach. His favorite television show is Daria, so go figure. He now considers New York City his hometown. In part, the events of September 11th brought that home to him. My wife, Kathy, is from Baltimore. We have a shelf in our home devoted to works by and about H.L. Mencken. Terry Teachout edited a second Mencken Christomathy, and he is the author of a book soon to appear, will appear this fall, published by HarperCollins, called The Skeptic, a biography of H.L. Mencken. He is here to speak to us on the theme of our lunchtime session, the restoration of truth and beauty. I certainly did not bring you beauty. He will bring you both. I present with great pleasure Terry Teachout.